So, as it's Mother's Day, I'm going to tell you a little memory I have of my mum. And what it was, she used to often tell us, there was four of us children, about this bridge. And it's actually the Tamar Bridge, which is crossing the River Tamar, which connects Cornwall and Devon. That's right. My mum was born in Devon. She's very proud to be a Devonian. But the bit she used to really tell us about, boast about, was the fact, I'm very proud of, is it was a bridge designed and built by Brunel. Is that exactly right? And I expect many of you heard of Brunel. If you haven't, he's been described as one of the most ingenious and prolific figures in engineering history. So it's, as you see, it's 19th century. Now, this bridge is still in use today. Okay, opened in 1859. It's still operational today. It's still deemed fit for purpose for carrying trains over. Okay, so that's how good it was. Now, some of you might know that my parents retired to Scotland. And would you believe that where they moved to was close to another bridge by Brunel? And this is globally famous bridge. It's a mile and a half long. It's the fourth rail bridge. Now, this one opened in 1890. And like the other one, it's still fit for purpose. Around 200 trains a day cross this bridge, except on strike days. Now, the reason for showing you these bridges is that if you look at the design, Brunel realized that the strongest shape you could make, if you're putting your girders together, I'm putting this very simply, the strongest shape you could make is a triangle, okay? Now, I checked this. I Googled, is a triangle the strongest shape? And this is what came up. Seriously, the first thing that came up. Triangles are the strongest shape there is, and explains why. Okay, so there's a bit more about triangles in my quiz, and I'll get to later why I keep looking at triangles. Now, these last few weeks, we've been looking at the Sermon on the Mount. And just a reminder that this is Jesus' teaching on the kingdom of God and how we're to live in that kingdom. What does it, essentially, what does it mean to live the Christian life? Living the Christian life means being a member of the kingdom of God. How do we experience that here and now? And so far, what we've seen in this message is a perspective on ourselves. You know, what are we to be like individually? It speaks about being poor in spirit, peacemakers, about loving righteousness, and so on. It's also given us a perspective on the world. What's our relationship with the world? It says we're to be like salt and light to influence the world. It's talked about what you might call moral law. You know, the Pharisees at the time were very much into a very outward religion, whereas Jesus was saying that really true religion, it comes from inside, what we're like on the inside. And then there's what you might call, say, religious practices like fasting, giving, praying. And last week, we looked at like money and possessions. What's our relationship to material things? Now, we're getting towards the end of the sermon now, the Sermon on the Mount, and there's a new theme introduced today, and that is our relationships with other people. Okay, relationships with other people. Now, we might say or instinctively feel, well, that's, you know, not the most important thing. What really matters is being right with God. And we might feel that this is a diagram which illustrates what the Christian message is all about. It's about man on earth and man as in mankind and God in heaven and us having a relationship with him. But actually, I think that a clearer picture, a clearer diagram of God's design is this. So I've got to the triangles at last. In other words, it's and man, again, is just a word for mankind. It's, yes, definitely both relating to God first, but then there's a connection between each other. And being in right relationship with each other, with other people, is intrinsic to being right with God. Okay, so that's the important thing. So it's a really important message. It's not at the end of the sermon because, oh, by the way, you ought to get on with each other. This really is an essential part of being part of the kingdom of God and living the life that God has designed. Now, the Pharisees once asked Jesus, what is the most important commandment? Read this in Matthew 22. They said they were testing Jesus with this question. What is the greatest commandment? And Jesus' answer was this. He said, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. Of course, that goes right back to the early part as the Bible. And he said, this is the first and greatest commandment. Now, that's the answer they were expecting. But then Jesus went on to say, and the second is this, love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments. And interestingly, in our reading, if you go to verse 12, it says very much the same thing. I haven't got this open, but you'll find it there. It says this, so in everything, do to others that you would have them do to you, for this sums up the law and the prophets. So I think this gives us an indication of the importance of not just being right related to God, but that's all tied up with being right related to each other. Here's another verse, which I think illustrates this very clearly. This is from 1 John, whoever claims to love God yet hates a brother or sister, and brother or sister means other believers, other people that we know, is a liar. For whoever does not love their brother and sister, whom they have seen, cannot love God, whom they have not seen. So we can't say, I'm sorted with God, I'm living the Christian life, I'm right with God, and yet be in wrong relationships with others. So that idea is a triangle. There's got to be at least another person, right, related to God, related to each other correctly. Now, with a triangle, if you break any part of it, strong as it is, so if you're not right with the next person, then the whole triangle is compromised. This is the effect. Okay, so it actually, if the lower level isn't right with each other, we can't say we're right with God and vice versa. So it's important that our relationship with God's right and it's connected to being right with each other. So this is a very important part of the sermon. So having said that, what does the text actually say? Well, it's verse 1 that we read. Straight away it says, do not judge. Do not judge, okay? Or you too will be judged. Now, I'm going to quote from Romans here. It says this, why do you judge your brother or sister? And why do you treat them with contempt? For we all stand before God's judgment seat. Now, so what that's telling us is that if we use a triangle, and I'm going to stick to this, through the, we've got to have a right view of God, and that will give us a right view of others. So if we see God as judge, if we recognize that God is judge, and we're all subject to his judgment, that he's the one who has the authority and the right to make that judgment in our lives, then that will disincline us from judging other people. Okay? When we rightfully fear God as the judge, then we will, you know, refrain. You know, we will be inclined to refrain from judging others. But what is this judgment speaking of? Now, it's not about that we mustn't make a right discernment or a correct judgment, but it's about not being very critical or censorious. It's about not sort of putting each other down. It's that sort of judgment. It's not setting ourselves up as if we've decided what standards other people must live by. So when we instead regard God as having that authority of being the judge, one we'll all give account to, it sort of humbles us, doesn't it? It makes us tend to be kind rather than critical. James 4 clearly says this, there is only one lawgiver and judge, the one who is able to save and destroy. So you see how the triangle works. We both view God as a judge, therefore we don't judge each other. Okay. So having the Lord and who he is in the right place gives us this correct perspective to each other. Now, there seems to be connections in the Bible about how we treat others and then how the Lord treats us. I mean, if you see even here in verse the beginning of our reading, it says, for in the same way as you judge others, you will be judged. The measure you use will be measured to you. There's a similar thing. If you go to the earlier chapter, to chapter 6, the Lord's Prayer, verse 14, it's got the Lord's Prayer, which we're all familiar with, I'm sure, and then verse 14 says this, if you forgive other people when they sin against you, your heavenly Father will forgive you. But if you do not forgive others their sins, your Father will not forgive you. So there's this connection between how we treat other people and how God treats us, okay? Now, this part of the sermon we're looking at today is also quoted in Luke, and it elaborates a little bit more. And it says, I've got it here in Luke 6:37-38. It says, do not judge, and you will not be judged. Do not condemn, and you will not be condemned. Forgive, and you will be forgiven. Then it says this, give, and it will be given to you, a good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over, will be poured into your lap. Okay, so it's used the imagery of a farmer selling their corn or grain. at the market. Now, if they said, right, you can buy a bag of corn for a shekel, you just pour it in, and then you pay the shekel and you give it to you. But if you're feeling really generous, if you shake the bag, of course, it settles, doesn't it? You can pour some more in, then press it down and shake it again. You can get more in. Now, sometimes at home, we buy 10 kilos, 20 kilos of rice, and we decant it into jars. And what I do, you pour it in. If you give it a good shake, it settles, and you pour some more in. So this gives us an image of the generosity and the magnitude of God's love towards us, of his forgiveness towards us. When God forgives us, it's like that. It really gives you as much as he can. Okay, so that's about forgiveness. So again, if we go back to our triangle, if each of us view God as the forgiving God and how generous his forgiveness is, then that will incline us to forgive each other. So it works, doesn't it, the triangle. But if we're unforgiving to other people, how can we say we enjoy God's forgiveness or value God's forgiveness? If we think we're beyond forgiveness and don't need it ourselves, why are we going to forgive others? But getting God in his right place and seeing that he's the forgiving God, when we know forgiveness from him, we're more likely to be forgiving. We're going to be forgiving to others. So moving on in this passage, it then goes on to say this, doesn't it? I'm on the wrong page. Excuse me a second. It says, why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? So it's this almost comedic sort of image of this hint that the speck is like something slightly wrong, but you've got something really wrong in your life. You know, how can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, when all the time there's a plank in your own eye? Okay, you hypocrite, first take the plank out of your own eye, then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. And what I'd like to do is look at three instances in the Bible where some judged others or were critical of others. Okay, three instances. And I think the first one is probably the clearest example of someone having a plank in their eye and yet criticizing or judging something perhaps smaller. And it's King David. And you may know the story about David and Bathsheba. Now, to cut it short, Bathsheba was a very attractive woman that David noticed, but she was married to somebody else. But he committed adultery with her, okay? And the result of that, she became pregnant. Now, David tried to cover that up in various ways, but he just couldn't get it to work. So the way he solved the problem was he got Bathsheba's husband sent to the very front line of the battle. The army were at war at that time, knowing that it was extremely likely he would be killed in battle, and he was. So effectively, David has committed adultery and murder. Okay, now it's pretty, pretty big ticket items, I'd say. And it says that the way that God addresses in David's life is that, and that's why the picture, Nathan came to David and told him a story about two men, a poor man and a rich man. The rich man had a huge herd of sheep. The poor man only had one little ewe lamb. Okay, one day, the rich man had a visitor, a traveller came to him, and rather than take one of his own sheep for a meal, he took the poor man's only little ewe lamb. And it says that David burned with anger against the man and said, the man must die. So he said, it's righteous anger, you know, it's real anger. And Nathan said to him, you are the man. Okay, now we might say, okay then, if that's judging others, I don't know everybody's past history, but you might say, well, I haven't done anything like that. I haven't committed adultery and got another man's wife, expecting with a child, then murdered the husband. Maybe we can't really relate to that. Well, okay, what about the next one then? We might be a bit nearer to home. The next one is a parable that Jesus told to address the Pharisees. Okay, and I'll read this one to you. It's a Pharisee and a tax collector. Now, just to say, tax collectors were regarded as the absolute scum of society. They were the lowest of the low. Their job was to collect taxes for the Romans, which is basically invading authorities that had come into their land. And also, they would tend to be cheats. So if you said tax collector, that was your euphemism for the absolute worst person. Whereas the Pharisees felt they were sort of really right and perfect before God. And this is how this goes. To some who were confident of their own righteousness, well, maybe do we feel like that sometimes, and looked down on everyone else, Jesus told this parable. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee, the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood by himself and prayed, God, I thank you that I'm not like other people, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. And he goes on to boast about how he fasts twice a week. Now, Mark kindly opened in prayer, but Peter stood up here and looked around and said, God, I thank you I'm not like the people in here. We'd have thought, well, maybe he needs taken down a peg or two. Now, but I know Mark wouldn't be anywhere near that, so it's only a tease. But if we heard that, we would regard that as someone very confident of their own righteousness. Now, maybe we might think, well, I wouldn't do that. You know, I don't think I've seen that in church. But do we sometimes perhaps think other ways where we think we're a little bit better? Present, we're saying indignantly to one another, why this waste of perfume? It could have been sold for more than a year's wages and the money given to the poor. And they rebuked her harshly. So that's judging her, wasn't it? Now, leave her alone, said Jesus. Why are you bothering her? She has done a beautiful thing to me. The poor you will always have with you, and you could help them any time you want, but you'll not always have me. She did what she could. She poured perfume on my body beforehand to prepare for my burial. Okay, so maybe just briefly have a look at a couple of questions at your tables. At first, did that criticism seem reasonable? At face value, when they saw that perfume being poured on Jesus' feet and saying, well, what about the poor? Did it seem reasonable? And secondly, what was it they considered? What hadn't they considered that brought a very different perspective to that situation? You know, in other words, from what Jesus explained to them. I've had a lot more time to think about it. The way I put it is, I would say that she put a very high value on honouring Jesus. Okay, they were putting a very high value on this perfume and thinking about maybe a more immediate problem, but she put a very high value on bringing that honour to Jesus. And it actually goes on to say, it says, truly I tell you, wherever the gospel is preached throughout the world, what she has done will also be told in memory of her. So Jesus was saying this is a really beautiful and significant thing. Now, I think the reason I did that is to say that, I'm going to show you one of my pet hates now, and I had plenty to choose from. So I really find it difficult when you're on a motorway and people are sitting in the middle lane doing literally 59 miles an hour, blocking the motorway. And yesterday I was coming back from Heathrow, there's four lanes, there was loads and loads of people in the third and fourth lane, literally doing about 55, 60. So I went up the inside lane at 70, not undertaking anybody, passing everybody. I feel so much better for telling everyone this, but sometimes I get stuck behind someone going very slowly and hesitant and holding me up and I'm anxious because I'm late for a meeting or something. But if I think about it, I try and think, well, why would they be driving slowly other than just to annoy me? It could be that it just helps to think through a scenario. Well, maybe that person has recently had a car accident themselves and they've just started driving again and lacking confidence. Maybe they've got an elderly or a younger person in the car who's ill or nervous about travelling, or maybe they're lost. Maybe they're actually going home from night shift. You know, they're very tired and they're just being really careful and actually struggling to drive. So there could be a number. In other words, if I knew all the facts rather than just criticise it, I might feel more gracious. And the way I phrase this is, if I go back to my triangle, you know, I like my triangles. If I put here about kingdom values, in other words, we said about the value of honouring Jesus was higher than the value of the perfume. And by this, I think it's, just to share a bit more from my own experience, is at home, there's things that I can find occasionally quite irritating. I've got to live with other people, but things not done the way I like them. And what's my reason for bring up everything that ever irritates me? What's my reasoning? Well, I was thinking about what principles are there that can help me with that. Now, I can think of two. Which I find helpful. One is, there's a verse which says, do your best to live at peace with all men, with all people. I think that applies in the home. I should do my very best to be at peace with people. And the second one is, which I probably should think about first, is about being a loving husband, how much I love my wife. Okay, now if you start thinking about those things, and thinking that's what God requires, I think, well, you know, I could express, I don't like this, I'd like that done differently, or that annoys me. I could do that, but when I do that, I set the atmosphere of the home. And we get to the end of the day and we're going to bed and think, have I injected sort of my frustration, irritation? Have I made people feel I'm disappointed in them, and not, rather than affirming them and making the home feel safe and secure and a loving place? So what's my ambition? What does God want me to do? So in other words, although, yeah, things might, and I'm sure there's things I do which irritate the others as well, but it cuts both ways. But it's, when I say having kingdom values, I've got a higher reason rather than just think, well, I better try and be patient or just buy self-controlled. And I think ultimately, you know, I want God to be patient with me. So having, what are the values? And this is a good reason to actually read the Bible, to look, what does it tell us about living as a Christian, and how does that apply in our homes? So I hope that's helpful, just to explain something about, you know, how we can be in right relationship with each other. So I think, conscious of time, what does it really mean about this not judging? What is it? Is it really? There's three possible scenarios. One is, apparently Tolstoy, the famous Russian novelist, he said that what Jesus meant by this, that there should never be any judgment at all, and we shouldn't even have law courts. There's no right for humans to judge other humans. So he went to the absolute extreme, said absolutely no judgment. Jesus saying, do not judge. I think what it is saying is, it's more about criticism. Stop criticizing each other. But it's not, it's sort of a mix of the two. It's not that you shouldn't use any judgment. The Bible clearly and regularly says we're to use discernment. Okay, so we're not to become sort of wishy-washy and just accept everything anyone says and never make any judgment or anything. But we're to be discerning. And what the Sermon on the Mount is bringing to us is a distinction between true and false religion. So that implies that we need to be discerning and making right judgments, okay? Now, Hebrews 5:14 says we're to discern between good and evil, okay? Now, the Pharisees, as an example, the Pharisees, they were very full of their own self-righteousness, and they constantly put others down. They put heavy burdens on them in terms of laws and so on. They were setting themselves up as judges. Their attitude wasn't motivated by wanting to help others to get right under God. You see, that was the backdrop where this sermon was spoken of. That was how they were being judgmental and critical. Now, it doesn't say, actually, if we look carefully, that we're not to make a judgment. It actually says that take the plank out of your own eye first, and then you'll see clearly to help the person with the speck in their eye. So in other words, it does say, get yourselves right with God first, and then we can help each other. So it does actually tell us that we are to make those right judgments. The psalmist, Psalm 51, create in me a pure heart, then I will teach transgressors your ways. So there is a place for us making right judgments. Even later in Matthew 18:15, if your brother or sister sins, go and point out their fault, it says. So it doesn't say never say anything, just sit back and let them do it. In fact, in Leviticus, it talks about not hating your fellow Israelite. To hate them is not to correct them. Love corrects. Love points out what's wrong. We're here to help each other find what's right and true, and to rid, you know, the things in our lives that are wrong. So we are, there is a point in a sense we can judge each other, but judge in the sense of discerning, but with a motive of wanting to help them. And even here in our reading this afternoon, the last verse, this, do not give dogs what is sacred, do not throw your pearls to pigs. Now that's saying we should make a discernment about who we share the gospel with. Now I would say this doesn't mean that we shouldn't share the message of the gospel with non-believers, and most of the time I would say we should. But if there are any that absolutely just rejecting it, they understand it, they think I have nothing to do with it, maybe they're blasphemous, the sort of people that Peter speaks about, 2 Peter, is false prophets introducing destructive heresies, even denying the sovereign Lord who bought them. Those are the sort of people that really anti-rejecting, throwing it back in your face. Don't keep giving them the precious pearls of the gospel. So I think that's what it's saying here. There are those that you may discern, you know, they don't want this. But in summary, I suggest that the way we get this right, how do we get the right balance here? It all comes down to attitude at the end of the day, doesn't it? We know when we're criticizing someone, whether we're just motivated because, you know, we want to make ourselves feel better, or maybe we're just getting caught up in some gossip. Maybe we're just feeling that, you know, that it makes us feel that we're more important to them. We know when we're doing it to exalt ourselves. Whereas actually, if our motive is to discern right to actually find truth and to honor God and to help them in their relationship with God, then that's a good measure. I think so. It's all about motive. If we need to go back, you know, to the Beatitudes, you know, is my behavior and my motives in line with those Beatitudes, being humble, being poor in spirit, being generous? Are we considering the very mercy of God towards us? Now, to conclude, I just want to say a few words about faith. What does it mean to have faith? You know, how does faith come into this? You know, maybe we read the Bible and think, well, do I believe it? Do I know God's there? You know, maybe you feel, well, I have some faith, but I'm trying to well up some more. What is it like? Well, I would say that we should consider James' word. James speaks about faith. And he references Abraham. He says, Abraham's faith was made complete by what he did. So the nature of faith is, it's not just something like airy-fairy, like, yeah, I believe there's a God there and he made the heaven and the earth. It's not as simple as that. Real faith is reflected in what we do. And in fact, it goes on to say, a person is considered righteous by what they do, not by faith alone. Okay. So if we're treating others rightly, out of a conviction that God is the right judge, that he's forgiving, that his precepts are right, then we're demonstrating faith. So when I was saying about perhaps, I consider those verses which affect my home life, my behavior at home, that's exercising faith. And that makes faith feel a lot more sort of tangible and achievable, if I can use that word. It's not us trying to well up, have we got faith? It comes out in actions. If you really believe that God is judge and also he's forgiving, you're going to humble yourself before him, and that's going to affect the way you behave towards others. That's exercising faith in God. That's the evidence of faith. And I think that more than ever, the church needs to be a safe place for all of us to come into, you know, and to be amongst others, a place that reflects what the kingdom of God is like. It's not a place where there's feeling judged or criticized, but a place where we discover grace. Now, in Galatians 5, it says this, the only thing that counts is faith expressing itself through love. Jesus said that. He said that's the only thing that counts. Paul said that, is faith expressing itself through love. So that doesn't really leave any room, does it, for judging and criticizing others. It only defines a desire to build each other up. So I wanted to move communion to after the talk, because I think an important part of communion is being right with each other. It says we shouldn't approach communion, you know, if we have some sort of area of disagreement or animosity or something that's unforgiven between each other. In other words, God is saying that it's important that in being right with him, that we're in right relation with each other.